Hi, nonprofiteers. Welcome to Nonprofit Biz Talk with your host, Tracy V. Allen, Nonprofit Strategist. Nonprofit Biz Talk is about giving you the knowledge, skills, strategies, and concepts to manage, build, and grow a nonprofit organization that will positively impact the community you serve.
Ida with me, who's going to talk to us about professional development in the nonprofit sector. Ida, welcome.
Hi, Tracy. I'm honored to be on your show. Thanks for having me today.
Great. So let's get started. Let's talk about professional development in the nonprofit sector versus professional development in the corporate structure. How do you think they're similar or different?
You know, Tracy, that's a great question. When I started out 20 years ago as a volunteer fundraiser, and then later became a professional person in the field, I was a corporate person. I was a financial analyst working for large corporations. And professional development in a corporate world was a given. It was, you had to attend certain trainings, whether it was, back then it was Stephen Covey was big, or yeah. Public speaking with Toastmasters, or... Mm-hmm. Updating your skills on the area of finance and analysis for the industry I was in. Those were required trainings, and there was a line item budget for them. But what I've seen in the nonprofit world, there isn't always a budget, or if there is, it's a very small one for professional development, which is kind of sad, because often nonprofit staff at different levels have to seek out their own extra development if they're not, funded for it. Mm-hmm. And well, thankfully, on that same note, there's a lot of great organizations like you, or companies and individuals like you, that do podcasts and webinars where people can learn. But if you were to ask me what piece of professional development is most needed for, I would say, the small to mid-sized nonprofit, where I see that lacking the most is an understanding of nonprofit financial management.
Okay.
You sit down with a small nonprofit leader and say, where's your budget? And you get like a deer in headlights look back, right? Like,
exactly.
What budget?
Yeah.
Like, you need to know where your revenue comes from,
right,
and where you spend it, mm-hmm, and not be that nonprofit that's flying by the seat of their pants. Because
exactly. As
we know, nonprofits need to be run like a business.
Yes, definitely. And it's not.
And that extra revenue should be reinvested back into the nonprofit for their mission. So,
okay. See, that's a good segue. It relates to professional development in the fact that it's compliance. Because I was reading an article the other day where there are a lot of nonprofit organizations currently getting their 501c3s taken away from them because someone in the nonprofit thinks that the nonprofit revenue budget is their personal bank account or their loan.
Ouch.
What I mean? So
not cool.
And I find this with a lot of founders, because they feel like, okay, I founded this nonprofit, or I own this nonprofit, like some of them like to say, which
they don't,
exactly, because it's a public entity, that they feel like, okay, I put, say, $8,000 into starting this up, and now I need to get my money back. So as donations come in, or they do fundraising events, and those funds come in, they're like, oh, well, my light needs to be paid this month. My kids' tuition needs to be paid, whatever it is. And they're just taking the money out of the organization willy-nilly, thinking that it's okay because, oh, I put money into it. So I find a lot, like I said, a lot of nonprofit organizations, especially the founders, feel like I own this nonprofit. I hear so many of them say that. And I'm like, no, you don't. You need to stop saying that. You sound horrible saying it.
Right.
It's the furthest thing from the truth. It shows a lack of education and in nonprofit management when you say
absolutely.
I own a nonprofit. And I keep telling them, like, you're going to go to jail if you don't stop dipping into your budget. Like, I don't know how else to say it. Like,
I agree. I would never dream of starting a nonprofit if I didn't have an accountant at least to oversee how I was running the books.
Exactly.
I mean, let's be honest.
Exactly. I can hardly run my own finances. I can't.
Exactly. Like, how could you think of starting a nonprofit without having somebody in the accounting world who understands rules and regulations that are related to financial management, mm-hmm. you know, in your corner? And you and I talked about this offline once, that part of that is the makeup of your board.
Yes.
I mean, if you're going to start a nonprofit, you need to make sure that you have professional and ethnic and all kinds of diversity on your mm-hmm, board. Mm-hmm. A lot of founders are really reluctant to do that because they're like, well, I'm giving up control. Well, the whole idea is flip that around. You're not giving up control. You're gaining skill sets.
So,
you're gaining ambassadors. You're gaining people who will help you.
Exactly. It's,
and
so,
it's
funny.
So hard to flip that around.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny that you mentioned that, giving up control. So when when I first talk, like I do my 15-minute consultation with a mm-hmm. someone who's thinking about starting a nonprofit organization,
mm-hmm.
the first mm-hmm. thing one of the first things or parts of a conversation that I will have with them is, are you a control freak? Are
Ooh,
you someone?
Good question.
Yes, because I know myself. I know that I like to be in control. So I ask them.
Same here.
Right. So I ask them, are you a control freak? Are you someone who needs to control every aspect? Well, not every, you know, you're not going to micromanage, but do you need to be the end decision maker? Because if that's what you need to do, if that's the type of person that you are, and I believe that people should know themselves, if you are the type of person who needs to have the final decision making power, then a nonprofit organization is not for you. And some people,
I would very much agree with that. I think mm-hmm. there's passionate founders out there. They've got the passion, they have mm-hmm. a vision, and they bite off way more than they can chew. I'm
yes.
thinking of one in particular from this event we had here in Maryland, a local nonprofit organization that houses, they provide co-working space.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give them a plug. They're the Nonprofit Village. They're a phenomenal organization here in Montgomery County, Maryland, where they have a co-working space mm-hmm. for, I think, up to 30 on-site tenants and then several others that are virtual.
That's awesome.
They hosted something called, 2 years in a row now, it's kind of like the Shark Tank, but it's mm-hmm. called the Duck Pond.
Right. Yep.
And I was one of the experts on the panel, and about, I think it was 12 nonprofits got to fill out some paperwork, and they were mm-hmm. small, you know, startups,
mm-hmm.
and they got to present their case to us and ask us questions and feedback. And the same thing came up over and over as we experts were interviewing them and looking at their documentation and then going, do you, your business plan is incomplete or you don't have one.
Right.
Or the documentation they submitted was 12 pages about how they'd like to do not one program, but 8 in a year.
Oh my
and we're
goodness.
Like,
oh, wow.
Back it. Reel it in. Reel it in. Yes,
oh
you can
my
see
goodness.
This, you know, this one lovely lady said, I want to help low-income mothers, you know, with paperwork to get, you know, federal, you know, subsidies or whatever they need. But I'd also like to find a space, brick and mortar, and run a daycare. We're like, whoa, 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 whoa.
I am almost certain, when you said 8 different things at one time.
Right. Right.
That person that you're talking about could be someone mm-hmm. that I spoke to recently, too. It sounds so familiar.
You know, it happens everywhere.
Yeah.
And you're in Connecticut?
Coach.
Oh, no. You're in New York. I'm in Maryland. So, yeah,
no,
it happens everywhere.
No, I'm
you're in
Connecticut.
Sorry.
But I don't work with people in Connecticut. They're all other places outside.
Yeah, me too. I work with nonprofits nationwide as well. But, I mean, this is the thing. This is the problem. These very mm-hmm. passionate, I mean, they're good-hearted people.
Yes, they are.
They don't
are.
Have
they
a business background.
Well.
They mean well, but they need to take one class called Nonprofit Management 101. And those are offered on the web. They're offered online. They're mm-hmm. offered at community colleges now. You know, when you and I were coming up through this business, my background is finance and international business. And then I studied and took a million courses and went to a million conferences and became a CFRE. I mean, that's kind of how it works. Now, there's classes in nonprofit management. I've taught classes in nonprofit marketing and communications. Mm-hmm. I've taught classes in nonprofit fundraising and development for the community college. So they have these now. And there's no excuse for the small nonprofit leadership or founder to at least seek out one course or an online course and really understand what it means to run a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. It's not, we'll do a fundraiser in January to pay the bills in February. Then we'll do a fundraiser in March to pay the bills in, you know, April. No.
Exactly. Please. And there are all these micro fundraisers that are not really making an impact on their revenue.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? I said, if you're going to go for a fundraiser, if you're going to take the time to plan it. And another thing with that fundraising, and I'm sure as a fundraising expert, one of the things that you see is that, like you said, from month to month or from quarter to quarter, they want to put a fundraising together, but they put the fundraising together a month before the actual fundraising date. And I'm like, way more time to court. I like to call it a romance, to court donors and sponsors than a month. You need at least a 6 months
more
head start.
At least.
You know, and I said a year would be best, but you need at least a 6 month head start. So,
And that brings us to a topic you and I talked about offline once before, which is having a development calendar.
Exactly.
And it's so important. You know, Giving Tuesday, you know, is coming. If this, we want to keep this evergreen, but let's pretend like it's not for now. It's October as we record this, and Giving Tuesday is coming. And my clients are running to me going, oh my God, we're not ready for Giving Tuesday. Ida, help, help, help. Okay, I'm going to help you calm down. We'll make it happen. We'll get the messaging right. We'll, you know, create a schedule of email blasts and, you know, Facebook posts. But what you really need to be ready for is your year-end giving campaign. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a whole other thing. And they're like, oh my God, do we really?
But a lot of people think it's one and the same. They think that giving
they're not.
Tuesday
no,
and year-end giving
not
campaign.
At all.
I'm like, they're two separate
not
things.
At all. They're two
Completely.
Different things. And,
yes.
And it's that whole idea of a development calendar. And I would create one for myself when I was a staff person running, you know, a development department for a larger nonprofit. I would create a calendar just in a Word document. Mm-hmm. January, tasks to be accomplished. February, tasks to be accomplished. Things like email frequency, newsletter, print newsletter frequency, and the timeline for that embedded in it. So you don't write the newsletter in a day. I mean, you start it about 2 months out. You start collecting articles. You start collecting stories from mm-hmm. staff. You start, you know, take the photographs, whatever you want to do. And then build that into your year-long development calendar.
Right. And that's a professional development in itself. Teaching
them
how to prepare for their year and not prepare from week to week or month to month. Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Time management. There you go.
Yes.
I would say one of the things I run into most with smaller nonprofits, and I understand it because their staff is stretched very thin. Mm-hmm. Even if you're stretched very thin, you really need good time management skills.
Right.
You really need to say, and I tell this to my donors, my clients all the time, you know, there's got to be a day a week where you just shut your door mm-hmm. for a couple hours and you pick up that phone and you make thank you calls to donors.
Yes.
You
yes.
Build those
I'm
relationships.
All about that. Exactly.
Build Bring those up. Relationships.
Act like
because
you're having a... Just like if you had a regular relationship, I said, you call your husband just because you want him to know
exactly.
you're thinking of him. You have to do the
right.
same thing with your donors. You just want
exactly.
to call them just because. I just
right.
thought about you, and I wanted to let you know how much we appreciate what you have done for our organization. Stop
right.
reaching out to donors only when you need money. It's not a good look.
So true. And guess what I coined this phrase a few years ago and others use it too. Mm-hmm. Don't treat your donors like ATM machines.
Yes. Very good. That.
And I actually, back then when I was first starting out on my own, I wrote a book and I commissioned an artist to draw a little caricature of a female fundraiser mm-hmm. talking to a male donor and the male donor's body is shaped like an ATM machine.
Oh wow!
and she's saying, "Hey, how you doing, so and so? We need a donation. Like, don't treat your donors like an ATM machine." Mm-hmm. And if anyone's interested, it's called "Tag Your It Now Raise Us Some Money" on Amazon.com.
Okay, great.
A short little primer mm-hmm. on how to be a good, you know, well developed, you know, fundraising development person. And just kind of the launch pad. But mm-hmm. the whole point of it is, like you said, fundraising is all about relationships. It's mm-hmm. the staff's relationships with the donors. It's board member relationships with donors. Mm-hmm. It's executive director's relationships with donors. Now, fundraising is a team sport.
Yes, it is. It is.
It doesn't all fall on a consultant. It does not ever all fall
and
on a consultant.
I don't know
or
how
staff.
You feel about it, because I did a Facebook Live about this maybe about a month ago, and I got some, you know, people are angry keyboard bullies. I like to call them little keyboard.
Really?
Yeah. Because sometimes you say things that people just don't agree with, or they don't want to hear it because it applies to them. So one of the things that I said, I lost my train of thought right now.
In your Facebook Live, somebody was a keyboard bully.
Yes.
Don't worry. I do this all the time.
What did you say before that? You were talking about.
I said that they're relationships. They're all about relationships. That
yes.
the relationships need to be board member relationships, you know, staff relationships, and, even
right.
volunteers relationships.
Right. So I was talking about building those relationships. And, oh, yes, I remember you said about the consultant.
Yes.
So I said that it's not the consultant's job and should never be. Okay, so I was talking from a grant writing perspective. Mm-hmm. So I was saying, as a grant writer and a nonprofit consultant, if I come into your organization to write, or you hire me to be a grant writer, I am coming in to write a grant for you, right? I'm not coming in to build relationships for you. If I come in mm-hmm. as a consultant, I can find you donors or founders that are funders that are applicable to your organization, but actually
right.
building the relationship with the people in these at the foundation level should be done by a staff member, not by
absolutely.
The consultant. And that's what
it doesn't
they got
mean the consultant.
Before.
Yeah, the consultant.
No, that's what
can
they got
facilitate
upset
it.
For. Yes.
Well, yeah, they should get it. They shouldn't get upset with you, because I have a very
yes.
good friend here who's a grant writer, and she's like, you know, I'm happy to go with you to a meeting,
mm-hmm.
and that's it. I'll write
exactly.
the grant, and then you need to continue the relationship
exactly.
beyond.
Exactly.
And then, you know,
because
if you want to stay in touch with them.
Organization. I
exactly.
don't work for your
right.
organization.
Right.
I am
mm-hmm.
here for a specific period of time. After I'm
right.
gone, your organization is still going to be there. So your board members, your executive director, your program directors, those are the people who need, or communications director, whoever in your organization, who's vested in your organization, they should be building, nurturing those relationships. You should have control of your Rolodex, not the consultant.
Absolutely. And I actually did a blog post on this called The Myth of the Fundraising, what did I call it? The Myth of the Fundraising Rainmaker.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of nonprofits think, you know, I can hire a fundraising consultant, and they're going to come in with their Rolodex.
Yes.
And they're going to just rain money all over the nonprofit. It does not work that way.
No,
it does
it
not
doesn't.
Work that way. And it's also a violation of different ethics codes in fundraising.
And that's
no,
one,
that's not
that's
to
one
say,
of the things I said. I said, you know,
right.
how do you think that if you are a nonprofit organization that deals with domestic violence, and I'm a consultant, so you're not my only client. You
right.
know, I have other
right.
clients. So how right. do you think that I am going to introduce you and form a relationship with a foundation for you and still form that same relationship with another with the same foundation for another nonprofit who has a
yeah,
similar
that's an issue.
Mission?
Yeah, that's definitely
values.
An issue.
That's a
right.
conflict of interest. I can't do that.
Right, right, right. And the bigger picture for me is, you know, I don't belong to country clubs. I don't have million-dollar friends.
Right.
And for you to realistically think that I've got some sort of magic Rolodex that's going to bring you money, it's just ludicrous. There is a profession out there, and I don't want to slam them in any way, called mm-hmm. fundraising solicitors.
Yes.
And there are solicitors. And I say, go on, because the state of Maryland has a website, mm-hmm. and most states do. And I'm listed as a licensed fundraising counsel, mm-hmm. which means I teach you how to go get the money. Mm-hmm. I teach you and your board how to be effective. Mm-hmm. I teach your staff how to message properly, how to communicate with donors. Heck, I'll even write your letters for you. You know,
right.
I'll punch up your annual report, mm-hmm. all that good stuff. But then I say, if that's not what you want, go on the state of Maryland website. You can find licensed solicitors. Mm-hmm. Have a nice day. That's just not what I do. Exactly. No, I'm not. Again, I'm not slamming solicitors. They do their jobs. But again, you have to realize, I mean, I worry for the small nonprofit that doesn't have, you know, ample deep pockets, mm-hmm. that they might end up paying for services that don't come back to them in the long run. Mm-hmm.
There's no.
So what I do when I work with boards is I give them the training, the tools, the elevator speech, the messaging. They need to go out in the community and to raise funds. And I break it down into very bite-sized pieces. And I say to them at the end of the meeting or the retreat training, you know, I'm giving you 2 months as a board to raise $10,000 because now I've taught you how to go get the money.
Right.
And most of the time, I will tell you, I'm very blessed. The people I work with, the board members, usually start out shy. Mm-hmm. But by the time I'm done with them in training, they're like, this isn't so difficult.
Right.
I had one board, I challenged them to raise $20,000 like in 2 months, mm-hmm. contacted them 3 months later, they'd raise $35,000. I mean,
that's
it can be done.
Awesome.
And I don't want to say it's not rocket science, but it's training. It's mm-hmm. training and being comfortable in your own skin. It's understanding that hearing the word no isn't fatal. You know, you're going to be doing a lot of asking. You might get more no's than yeses, and that's okay.
Right. Exactly.
And, you know, if you've got the passion and you're on the board of a nonprofit, you're there for a reason because you feel passionate about it. Mm-hmm. Let that passion speak for you and watch it rain.
Right.
That's what I say. Don't tell me I'm going to make it rain because you're the one that's going to make it rain.
So we talked about budgeting being one
yes.
of the top professional developments that you think a nonprofit should have. What are
yes.
two others that you think that they should have? Like,
we said budgeting, financial management, mm-hmm. Management skills in general.
Okay.
Is something I find leadership skills.
Mm-hmm. Leadership skills. Good.
Yes, mm-hmm. absolutely. Leadership skills, management skills. Mm-hmm. What else off the top of my head?
What about
basic
compliance?
Marketing? Oh, compliance, definitely. And if you don't have a great, you know, CPA firm in your corner mm-hmm. that can help you with that, definitely learn about. And, you know, by the way, you know this and I know this. Every state has different rules. There's
yes.
federal rules. There's state rules.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you really have to go onto your state's website for, in Maryland, I think it's called the charitable division.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever it is in your state. And look at the regulations there and look at the rules and the paperwork and make sure you are compliant.
Right. Especially like when it comes
sure,
to fundraising. A lot of people
mm-hmm.
don't realize that with the insertion of social media, that they could be breaking some fundraising laws because they're not registered
True.
In certain states. And I've had kickback on that too. They're like, that's crazy. People have told me that's crazy. So you're expecting me to register in 40 states. I'm like, yeah, that's the kind of like the law, you know, because if you are soliciting online and you could be getting funds from anybody everywhere, you know,
that's a really good question.
Yes.
That's a really
I've
good point. People need to,
and
I see
basically you should be registered. Yes. You know, so,
you know, there are organizations and there's one here in Maryland, mm-hmm. I know of that will accomplish for not a huge amount of money, really,
mm-hmm.
your nationwide registration for every state
yeah. mm-hmm.
charitable. Yeah. There's companies that will do that for
mm-hmm.
you. So
yep.
I'm all about delegating,
mm-hmm.
you know, you
yeah.
have to do this, what I call a cost benefit analysis.
Of
right?
course.
So is it worth 5 hours of my time as a nonprofit, let's say founder, to go on the internet and spend 5 hours because I'm trying to save some money
yes.
and do this all myself? Or do I pay a company a few hundred dollars to just take care of it?
And I love that. I love the fact that you just said that because that's something that
right.
I tell organizations
right.
all the time when they
right.
Argue about what I charge. And I'm like, I'm not. What I charge is what I charge. You're paying me for my time and you're paying me most of all for my knowledge. Granted,
of
you can
course.
Go Google it. You can read a book about it. But at the end of the day, when you have finished reading it and you have finished Googling it, you still have to implement it. And
right.
that's only if you understood it. because that's a whole other component to it. Did you understand it enough to implement it? How much, so if you wanted to start a nonprofit, you've never started a nonprofit before, to do all the reading and the research and everything could take you a year to truly get a true understanding of it versus paying someone and they can get it done for you in like 3 weeks.
Right. And you know, there's always that IRS backlog of how quickly they turn around 501c3 you know, acceptances.
I think and they need to be a little bit more discerning right now because...
Yeah, of course, because of worldwide events, it's taking a little bit longer. And, you know, that whole window of time can be anywhere from 3 months to 9 months for them to come back to you and say that your application is complete or incomplete.
Right.
And a lot of founders, I mean, don't realize that that's a process. Mm-hmm. And we also talked about, you and I, earlier about that starting a nonprofit doesn't mean, you know, just throwing down some names on a piece of paper to be your board of directors, just to have them there like warm bodies, like, oh, I'll just put my mom and my neighbor and I'll, you know, no, you really need to think through who you want on your board. And that's where the idea of that board matrix comes in, and having, you know, ethnic and professional and age diversity and all types of diversity. Because when I'm sitting down, if I were the founder of a nonprofit, and a lot of founders, let's face it, you know, I'm a control freak, they're control freaks too. Uh-huh. Founders of nonprofits, you know, sometimes just want a bunch of people in the room, they're going to nod yes.
Yes.
But spin that around for a minute. If you're making major decisions for your nonprofit, and you're convinced you're right, I would love somebody to play devil's advocate so I know that I'm right. And if I'm not right, tell me why. Tell me why. You know, if I have an idea and somebody on my board, you know, is an attorney and they say, well, you might want to hang on to that idea for a while, but I don't think we're there yet. As a founder, I'd want to be open to that information. So some founders look at a board as, oh my God, I'm giving up control if I have other people on the board. No, look at it as they're going to help you take this to the next level because you've got extra expertise that's free. Free expertise. You know, this is the best thing ever. You know, if you're not sure how to market your fundraising event and you have a board member that's a marketing professional, you've got it made. They're going to help you.
Right.
So
they're going to help you.
It's a common problem.
Right. Sometimes what I see that can happen is that if you have someone who's a lawyer or a accountant on your board, sometimes you tend to want to overuse that person. They cannot be your accountant or your lawyer.
There you we don't burn out our board members.
They
we don't burn
like
them out. We don't create conflicts of interest. No,
that's what they should be. First and last,
right?
But there should be
a person
in between who's actually the organization's lawyer or the organization's accountant. But they should.
I love how you put that. First look, last look. Mm-hmm. That is a great way to put it. You rely on your board members for input, but remember, you need outside professionals. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That is just so true. And, you know, over and over, we see very well-meaning, kind-hearted, big idea founders. You know, they're taking out second mortgages on their home.
Mm-hmm. Which is ridiculous. And,
you know, I just, a big lump in my throat when I talk to them, like, no.
Right.
Oh, but they're so convinced that this is going to work that they've just, they bought into their own Kool-Aid. And
but let's talk about how it can work. Let's,
let's talk about that.
So one of the things that I talk about a lot is that pre-work. That's what I like to call it, the pre-work. So before you even start filling out any paperwork, before you start looking at a board, well, this can probably go into the pre-work as well. But one of the things I think that people who are trying to start a nonprofit organization need to do is to start networking, strong networking. Start talking about what you want to do and how you want to do it. Start making connections to people who can become potential donors, community partners, and volunteers before you start your paperwork. To me, that will give you a better sense of how it will be received within the community. So do yep. all that.
I have something to add to that. Yep.
Reaching out to something people great. Within, yep. yeah, reaching out with to people within that specific community. See what they want, what they need, and how best to deliver it to them. Because I keep talking about that big idea. So we are very, as people, we're self-centered in a way, you know what I mean? So we have our own thoughts and ideas and this euphoric sense of how we're going to do something. And we're not thinking about the people outside of it, the people who are receiving mm-hmm. it. We're thinking about how it looks to us, mm-hmm. how we mm-hmm. want it to be, how best it's going to be for us, and not how mm-hmm. the person actually using the product is going to interact with it. So this is why you need to talk to the people who you are going to be serving to see exactly mm-hmm. what their needs are. Do a survey. Survey maybe say exactly. 50 people in the community. Right. What is your pain point? And how right. can I serve that pain point to make it accessible and usable for you?
You know, Tracy, you hit the nail on the head. I'm going to rewind back to that duck pond conversation we had mm-hmm. earlier, where these nonprofits, wonderful meaning nonprofits, came up and presented. One of the first questions we asked them was, did you scan the marketplace and do any benchmarking to see if somebody else isn't already doing what you're trying
right.
to do?
Yep.
and many times they said, no. Like, okay, so let's pretend for a moment, Tracy and I don't want to open a domestic violence shelter for women, which is a wonderful thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's probably always needed everywhere. But if the town we both live in already has 6 of them and they've got empty beds,
then you don't need it.
Then we don't need to be doing that.
So and you can go and volunteer your services there, start a program right, with one of these right, people instead right. of starting another nonprofit organization.
You don't need to start another nonprofit. Right.
You're you can diluting take your the idea. Funding pool.
right. You're diluting the funding pool. Second, it's like saying, there's 3 supermarkets on my street. I'm going to open a 4th supermarket.
Exactly.
No. You know, yeah. mm-hmm. supermarkets don't do that.
No.
The drugstores don't do that. Mm-mm. You know, think about it. And they don't. They go, but I know there's a need out there. How do you know? And that comes back to what you said, Tracy, is did you survey your audience? Did
right.
you talk to others in the field and see if there's any additional needs? But mm-hmm. over and over during that duck pond, we were saying, have you looked around this county to see who else is doing it? Are you filling a niche that they can't fill?
Right.
Are you doing something differently, for example, or are you complementing other services? So it all comes back to, like you said, how did you put it? Taking a year mm-hmm. to prep yourself before you actually, you know, flip the switch and start a nonprofit.
Yeah.
That's research skills.
Right. And speaking to
so
a professional.
There's another professional development. Right.
Right. Taking the time right. to get a nonprofit professional in there and talk
there
to them
go.
And let them help you through the process. You don't know it all. You know, you probably
right.
don't know anything at all. Besides mm-hmm. that, you have a mission that you want to accomplish. But I did a blog post on 6 alternative. I think it was 6 alternatives to starting a nonprofit organization. You don't have to start one. And
wow.
people might say, that's crazy. Why would you say that as a consultant? Because I'm not in the business of being a consultant just for money. I'm in the business of being a consultant because I like to help people and I don't like to see people fail. And I'm not going to
right.
encourage people to start something that I know is not, or possibly, I shouldn't say no, because I don't have a crystal
right.
ball, but that would possibly not work because like you said,
right.
they're diluting the pool. If there's 6 other nonprofit, domestic violence shelters in my neighborhood and they have empty beds, why am I going to start a 7th?
Right.
It doesn't make sense.
That's the whole idea is that, that really passionate founder sometimes has these blinders on
mm-hmm.
and they need someone like you or me, or even, you know, somebody else in the industry who at least is in that sphere of influence, whether it's domestic violence or whatever, to sit them down and say, here's what the needs are,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, coaching from a professional consultant that's going to walk them through. Well, let's sit down right now together and do a Google search. Let's actually research this right now. You know, a couple hours of my time coaching you is going to save you thousands of dollars in loss and worry and sadness because what you wanted to start didn't take off the way you wanted.
Right.
That's the way it
works. Because no matter what you're doing, whether it's starting a nonprofit organization or starting a for-profit organization, for-profit business, you need systems and processes in place. Nothing can survive systems and processes. And
right. It
takes you forever, because I know when I started my consulting business, it took me a long time because I'm a systems and processes type of person. Like, I mm-hmm. need forms for everything. So, and it took a long time to create them. I mean, I have other people in our group, like, you know, oh, they don't have a form for it. Oh, I have a form for it. You know, I can share
right.
because that's just what I'm a systems and processes type of person. I need to know what's going on, when it's going on, and that
right.
type of stuff. You know what I mean? So
right.
that's one thing that you need to make sure that you have as a nonprofit founder or leader is systems and processes. And this is where professional developments can come in and help you out. You know, you cannot be cheap with professional developments. Just like if you were a teacher, we have to have a certain amount of professional developments per year. If you are a doctor, you have to do a certain amount of professional developments per year.
Absolutely.
You need professional developments for your leadership staff, which includes mm-hmm. your ED, your program director, communications director, board members. You also need
right.
professional development for your volunteers. You cannot forget
sure.
about them. You know, they're there
right.
doing you a, I don't like to say free service because volunteerism is not free.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's how I look at it. It's not free because you really should have a volunteer coordinator. So you're paying somebody
right.
to oversee the volunteer. So it's not really free. And you
right.
should have workman's compensation for your volunteers as well. At least I always tell, because if something happens to your volunteer on, even though it's the Good Samaritan law, we live in a litigious society. We live in a litigious society, get workman's compensation,
right.
paying that extra, maybe say $100 per month
right.
can save you a lot of heartache.
Yeah, I'm definitely not an expert in that, but I mean, a lot of nonprofits avoid either workman's comp insurance or general liability insurance, which is a big mistake. And I'll leave that to the insurance expert.
They need to have,
but yeah, everybody needs that.
I just put up a post yesterday about, I think it was 6 different insurances that you need to have as a nonprofit organization, and workman's comp
wow.
was there.
Wow.
Workman's comp was there. 6,
wow.
like 6 or 7. And if you work with children, that's number 8.
Oh, that's another one, right?
Yes.
Sure.
Actually, there are 2 other insurances you need to have if you're working with children. Because, you know, somebody slips
through the
crack.
Well, there's a reason, but that's
yeah.
the reason right there.
That's
anybody
another professional development. You need to.
Right.
Professional
right.
development is so pivotal to the success of a nonprofit organization. I mean, we could
right.
sum this whole thing up in that one statement. It's pivotal to your success.
It is pivotal, especially,
yeah.
and I'll come back to, because the staff that I work with the most is EDs, boards, and fundraising staff. And I will tell you that, you know, there's certain things, especially in fundraising, that don't change from year to year, and there's just best practices in working with
right.
donors.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always great case studies and new ideas, and you know, the whole idea of generational changes. Like, there's now all kinds of data on millennials.
Right.
There's all kinds of data on, you know, baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
That these are things that, especially the fundraising, marketing, and communications staff need professional development on, pretty much on an annual basis. I mean,
okay.
you really need to be getting to conferences and seminars where experts are speaking on these topics. I do it. How do
so
I
that's
keep...
one of my questions to you is
I do it. I have to.
Yeah. Where do you think these should occur? Should it happen at the base camp of the nonprofit organization? Should it happen
mm-hmm.
outside? Or do you think they
mm-hmm.
need a good combination of both?
Well, I think it works two ways, Tracy.
Mm-hmm.
There's you know, the Association of Fundraising Professionals, the Direct Marketing Association. There's all types of
right.
organizations that host conferences and seminars and even webinars online, but around the country. And there's some top-notch ones, and you know, you can Google and find them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the general knowledge, that the pool of general knowledge out there annually that I like to tap into. I attend, you know, one, two, maybe three conferences a year, just to soak up like a sponge. What's new, great, and exciting?
Right.
You know, forever learning. What's a little nugget that I can take and latch onto and use that to help my clients?
Right.
But then again, I would say there's the customized professional development. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
Where an organization leader could sit down with you and say, you know, our staff is, or our board is lacking in knowledge about A, B, C, or D.
Exactly, exactly.
And then we put together what they need in sort of either a retreat format, mm-hmm. or one-on-one coaching format, or small group coaching. Mm-hmm. And I think both are essential to any nonprofit. I really believe that.
So you kind of segued into my next question. What are your thoughts on retreats? Effective, not effective, too expensive? What do you think?
You know,
and how often should they happen?
Right. Are you talking about staff retreats or board retreats? Let's talk about that for a minute. They're a little different.
Let's talk about both. Let's talk about both.
Okay. I think either of those are only going to be effective if there's well planned out objectives and outcomes in advance, and a very well written agenda. So either of those has to have both.
Okay.
So either of these has to have all of that. They have to have a well thought out, why are we doing this? What are the objectives? What are the outcomes we're trying to reach? And what is the agenda for the day or the 6-hour retreat? So my answer is yes, they're good things. If they're planned and done properly.
Okay.
So I would say annual, mm-hmm. especially on the board level. It's a great opportunity to review the strategic plan of the organization as a group.
Yes, it is.
And go through it and say, what areas have we accomplished and what have we not accomplished? And are we going to modify the strategic plan, whether it's a 3-year plan, 5-year plan, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But that's one good reason. One of the other retreats that I helped facilitate for a client was beyond the strategic plan. It was a smaller nonprofit. They just needed thinking through their next year, month by month, what tasks need to be accomplished on the program side, mm-hmm. what need to be accomplished on the fundraising side. So that's another way to do it. Again, it's all based on what's the outcome. You know, let's think about what the outcome needs to be. Another retreat I participated in, for example, I was a 3-hour trainer in a 9-hour retreat. So I wasn't in the rest of the retreat. I only had a 3-hour chunk of that. Mm-hmm. My role was board fundraising training.
Okay.
So they built that into their retreat for me to come in and you know, help them get over being shy about asking for money.
And so I think that's one that all nonprofit organizations need to have is
board fundraising
development.
Right.
Because I think I could safely say, you can tell me if I'm wrong, maybe about 90% of beginning or startup nonprofits to mid-level nonprofits, that is one of the major issues I've heard them complain about.
My board does
not want to fundraise.
Right, mm-hmm. right. I actually posted a blog on this too, and it's called What Can You Get Them to Do Instead in the Meantime? There's things you can get them to do if they're not going to ask for money, but eventually you need to get them to where they're, I call it ambassadors for your organization, mm-hmm. and people who are involved in resource acquisition.
Right.
Your board members should be involved in resource acquisition to move the nonprofit forward.
Okay.
Flipping to the staff side real briefly, mm-hmm. I think a staff retreat or a staff team building day mm-hmm. is such a great morale booster because
it is.
You know, nobody works at a nonprofit for the glorious salary. Nobody works there because the hours are cushy. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all wearing multiple hats, whether they're program directors or ground level staff or nurses or whoever. And I've seen some of my clients, I wasn't part of their staff retreats, but they'll post them on Facebook and they're all wearing, you know, t-shirts that look the same and they've had this big picnic and everybody's got a big smile on their face. And it's like, you know, corporations do that. They have a company picnic.
Exactly.
You might not call it a retreat, but, you know, some way to recognize the staff. If you feel the need, you know, maybe at the mid to upper management level to do a staff retreat where they actually talk about program goals and accomplishments and motivations for the year ahead. Mm-hmm. But again, it all comes down to what are your objectives? What are your outcomes? Having a retreat for a retreat's sake where everybody's falling asleep and they want it to be over and they want to go home is not the way to do it. It has to be high energy. It has to be interesting. It has to be useful. And it has to have action items. So that's a long answer for you. I'm sorry, but that's a long answer.
That's fine. I wanted to make the point that one of the things I always recommend to combat having to have so many professional developments with your board to get them to be comfortable with fundraising is that when you initially recruit your board, you should have a clear, a very, very clear and precise job description. It is a job, even though they're volunteering, it is a job. And one of the key topics that should be addressed in that initial meeting is fundraising. I think if it is put on the table initially and talked about openly, there would not be so much apprehension when
I agree with you. I agree with you. And here's what I boil this down to. If you've got a new board and a new nonprofit, come up with a set of board policies.
Right.
And those policies can include the following. Gift giving policy on behalf of board members.
Right, because they should be they should have
a minimum
amount.
Gift.
Yes.
Sure, and a minimum gift. It could be a give or a get, as we call it. It could be also other policies are, believe it or not, there should be an attendance policy.
Yes.
So if your board has 6 meetings a year, you should be required to attend 4 out of 6 or whatever the group agrees upon. There's also other policies, taking you a little bit off topic. I was thinking about this morning, gift receiving policy. So let's say there's a millionaire who, the only example I could find this bizarre. Let's say you operate a nonprofit for children, but there's a gentleman out there who is extremely wealthy. He'd like to give you $1 million, but his business is not child friendly. It's actually child detrimental. I'm not going to give examples, but think of really, really bad things out there on the internet, right? So you could have a gift acceptance and refusal policy. You know, you're not
and
required to take
be,
a million.
Right. All this should be outlined in your bylaws as well.
And the bylaws or addendums to bylaws or a board policy manual that's been voted upon. I help clients create those board policy manuals. There's Board Source, as you know, is a great source of information for that as well. So I think you're so right. And I actually left a phone message today for a colleague because I know she's on the board of a brand new nonprofit. And I said, you know, I'd love to talk to you for a few minutes on the importance of board policies.
Yes.
And let's just have a few minute conversation. And I'm just going to give her some ideas and whether she ends up retaining
it
doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I don't care. I want her to know, like you said, we want to make sure people do this right. That's my first ethical commitment to my position as a, you know, my consultancy is to make sure that it's done correctly. And whether they end up working with me or somebody else, that's fine. But if you're starting a nonprofit and you don't have board policies in place, when you start recruiting new people or you suddenly spring upon them, oh, you're on this board, you've been on this board for 6 months, now we expect you to give $500 a year, and they give you a look like, are you kidding me?
Right.
Well, that's because they weren't told upfront.
Upfront, exactly. Exactly.
So, it should be done upfront.
Right. So let's try and wrap this up. And
we're going to we could talk all day, couldn't we?
I know we can. We really, really can, because this is we have to do another one together. So
we
I will
should.
Definitely
be
have
happy
you back
to.
And we can discuss some other topics. You're welcome back here anytime, because I really
you.
Enjoyed this. And I think that my audience will learn a lot from this conversation.
Well, I can't wait to share it with my audience too.
Yes.
This is gonna be great.
Exactly. So when it comes to cost, because I know everyone is listening to us and they're going, okay, they're talking about all of this great professional development, but what does the cost look like for our organization? Because we know that revenue is a big thing within, especially smaller nonprofit organizations to mid nonprofit organizations, and they're the ones who need it the most. Not that larger corporation organizations don't need nonprofit development. I mean, professional development. They know they need it. They've already budgeted for it. So we're not really talking about the big ones because they know the importance. They, you know, like I said, they've already budgeted for their professional development. And like I tell people sometimes, you know, if you don't believe how important it is to have professional development, go look at like Susan G. Komen's, their 990s, and you'll see how much money they spend every year on professional development. Look at the Red Cross. I said, it's there. Right. There's a line for it. You can see the amount of money. Professional development is a valuable asset for your organization. So what kind of figure, based on what we've talked about and the key trainings that they may need, and maybe some other, like the top three and maybe two or three others that they would need to have on a yearly basis, what type of budget would you tell them that they need to have?
You know, I would say it would have to be based on their budget. In other words, is it less than 1% of their whole budget? Is it going to be, it's so arbitrary, Tracy. Right. It's so hard to say, but if nothing else, I think EDs and program level staff and definitely development staff should be given a budget to attend one major conference a year, with including travel and hotel.
Okay.
You know, so one major, maybe multi-day conference, let's say, where they're going to get training, where they're going to get networking with peers. That could range. I mean, it depends on where you are in the country. It could be anywhere from, you know, $500 to $1,000.
Right.
Whether it's, you know, individual coaching type development, again, it depends on the nonprofit's budget. But whether it's, you know, conferences or individualized, personalized, you know, training and coaching, it needs to be there. And it needs to be there based on the dollar amount should be realistic to the organization.
Yes.
So if the organization's annual budget is $1 million, they're not going to spend $10,000 on professional development. Let's be honest. I mean, they shouldn't. That's going to be their accountant, maybe, or that's going to be their, you know, whatever. But, you know, it needs to be thought through carefully. It needs to be something that the leadership can agree upon is necessary, first of all. And then what you and I and other colleagues like us like to do is sit down with the client and say, what is it that you feel your needs are? And what do you think your budget is? And let's work within that.
Right.
So what we can do is say, got 10 needs and you've got this much budget. Well, guess what? Tracy and or Ida, we can help you with these top three for now based on your budget. And then when your budget year rolls around or 6 months later, you have a little extra, you know, income and you can keep it going, then let us know.
Exactly.
We're not, kind of explain this, fundraising and professional development and nonprofit management consultants, we want to work with you. We want to work within your budget. We want to work within your needs. You know, I could come up with a laundry list of 100 items that every nonprofit should have, but I realistically know that they can't afford them.
Exactly.
And let's be realistic. Let's get down to what your priorities are. What's your first priority, second priority, third priority? Where are you struggling the most? And let's take it from there.
Okay. That's a great way to wrap this up. What are you struggling with the most? And sitting down with the consultant and having them prepare something that is specific to your needs. Okay,
that's absolutely
great. Ida, why don't you tell my audience where they can find you?
Oh, thank you, Tracy. Well, my name is spelled a little differently. It's A as in apple, Y as in yes, D as in dog, A as in apple. But it's pronounced Ida. And my last name, which is also, this is all my website, Ida Sandberg. Last name is S as in Sam, A as in apple, N as in Nancy, V as in Victor, E as in egg, R as in red.com. So IdaSandberg.com. I have a Facebook page that says Ida Sandberg Consulting. I'd love you to go there and like it and follow my posts. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'd love to connect with you on LinkedIn. Again, my first and last name. My Twitter handle is my first name, A-Y-D-A, Ida. S as in Sam, C as in consultant. And it's at Ida SC. Love for you to chat on Twitter. Follow me there. And I can't think of anything else. There's a bunch of ways to reach me. But or you got Tracy's website. She knows where to find me.
Yes. And I'll definitely
you got the
information.
You got the podcast link, and yeah,
yes, exactly.
It, so.
I'll put your information.
I do offer 30-minute telephone consults to established nonprofits. Mm-hmm. I have a very small, inexpensive fee-based package for people thinking about starting a nonprofit, and I have other service packages with some pricing on my website.
Okay, great.
Feel free to browse the website.
Awesome, awesome. Thank you again for being here, and I
thank
really
you for having me, Tracy. This
You're
was
welcome.
Like too much fun.
And I hope
I am so
I
happy
to be a guest again.
I hope so too. I'd love to do it anytime you'll have me.
Okay, great.
Take care.
Okay, nonprofiteers, that's it for today. Thank you for joining us. And remember that there's someone in your community counting on the services that your nonprofit organization offers, and it is your job to make sure that you get it right. Until next time, I'm Tracy V. Allen. We'll be right back.